profile, the military changes, a lot of other aspects of the military will change as well. Secondly, I am not convinced, I have never been convinced for that matter, that the various kinds of requirements for status or whatever sort in the military have any relationship to reality anyway.
Eventually, I think that the church is going to finally do its job and support the minister serving the people in the military, and we will not be used to that. Or wear the rank. When the church does its job and provides service for the people in the military and stop turning us over to the government to support us, then I think we can.
You anticipate part of what I mean about the changes I see in the orphan. Yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier about the constancy in the form of prejudice and so forth, and you linked that up with the caste system and the class system. I'd like to ask you to go out on a limb, if you would, and see where you see us going now, and what you see to hold.
For the first time, I started to say a few minutes ago and got sidetracked, for the first time in the history of this country, the class system has some pinpricks on it. And by that I mean that there are a few blacks in this country who have, for all practical purposes, escaped from the black caste and have entered the class system. And this has tremendous implications. I was speaking to a group of black Methodists in Atlanta about 4 weeks ago, and they were having a huge conference there, and their chief concern was what are the implications of the middle class mentality of the Methodist Church for black people? And what they didn't realize at the moment was that the Methodist Church has been middle class for at least three generations, since the 1880s, and that it has slipped imperceptibly by the Baptists and the Catholics and the Mormons and such other groups and lodged itself very quietly but very securely just above the Lutherans and just below the Presbyterians, and that's about as middle class as you can get. Now, what my black brothers were really troubled about, perhaps without realizing it, is that here in this post-war, World War II situation, with increasing economic and educational opportunities for black people, that some of them have become, or are becoming, or think they are becoming, middle class, and they have tremendous good feelings about the brothers down below. So it became my job to help them to see where they were. And already it is a phenomenon among the new black middle class to work for, but not with, to be the advocates of, but not the friends of, to have the lower class blacks perform in their churches, same way whites used to do, but not have them worship with them and so on. So, like the same kind of syndrome. And they have tremendous guilt feelings about it. So I simply told them that they have tasted the fruit of the middle class vine, they'll never know innocence again. And we're unhappy about all this. And I got scored in some of the folk rooms, but this is precisely what has happened. Now, so then, if you ask me how I feel about it, I would say that for the first time, a very small minority of blacks is finding its way out of the caste system and into the class system, and that this is perhaps the most significant breakthrough in race relations of the country for the last 100 years because of the implications of all this. Also, I saw somewhere recently statistics for which I can't be responsible, but statistics to the effect that the black consumer market in the United States now is as great as that of all but 6 countries in the world. Again, I don't know if this is true, but take it for what it's worth. This would mean that 6 countries in the world have a greater consumer market than the black people in this country. Again, this has tremendous implications. So then, what seems to be happening is that a few blacks, though increasing by small percentage points, are about to become American in the full-fledged sense of the word. The problem is that for the black masses, nothing has happened. Nothing has changed for the black masses in the last 50 years, and not much is likely to change in the immediate future. So this is where the seat of the problem is. I'm sorry?
The word nothing is hard to say. Because the advances made since 1955 certainly preclude the use of the word nothing.
What you will have to do is to show me that the life circumstances of the masses have been perceptibly fulfill
because in other words, you are being selective then in the area to which you would apply. You wouldn't apply the same principle, for example, to a doctor or to a PhD as you are.
Whatever the service that is being pursued, it is being pursued effectively. That's what I am asking. I do not believe that the chaplains exist primarily for the promotion of his offices. I believe that it exists primarily for the effective ministering to the people who are in the military and under stress. And I am suggesting that it may at least be worthwhile considering that if you are going to utilize soldiers with, let us say, a low level of academic achievement, and you're going to do that in fairly large numbers, it may not be necessary to have PhD chaplains to minister to them. As a matter of fact, I would be inclined to suggest that the PhD chaplain can administer effective.
I can buy what you say in principle. I have difficulty in application. For example, if I were to go to a medical doctor, I would want the most highly trained doctor possible. Another may be able to...
I interrupt you. The best educated clergyman is not necessarily all the most effective.
No, the most effective doctor.
I think the analogy between a medical officer and a clergyman here is a false analogy. And what I said anyway was that if he is ministering effectively, I would be even willing to go further out on the limb and say that if a rich doctor can minister more effectively to a given clientele than can a surgeon with all kinds of postgraduate degrees, you have to rest on that.
The difficulty I would have is how do you determine whether he is effective or not? And then you get into the very...
The only way that you can determine that is by the satisfaction exhibited by the person on the receiving end, and not by any external criteria. And this is particularly true of religion. I am certain that you have experienced, or that you will experience, a sense of total loss and ineffectiveness in really reaching certain kinds of people. And that you must know that people with a lot less formal skill than you have, and a lot less education, might be able to reach the point end. This is what I say. I have no quarrel with the chaplains. I never really considered that before. But in the nature of religion, particularly in a society where you have a religious spectrum such as ours that runs all the way from Roman Catholicism and various Orthodox religions over to the most bizarre cults, and all of these people are distributed in the military, then it is, when you stop to think about it, not an unreasonable idea, I don't think. And sure, I know that it would be far more effective to have a black Muslim minister with a fourth-grade education to look out for the spiritual needs of black Muslims than to have Captain John DeGroe with such a PhD. He couldn't do it.
The same would apply to the field of education.
Sir?
The same would apply in the field of education.
A general principle.
All right.
Sir, what he's trying to do, he's trying to justify what now exists. Right? That's the feeling I get.
Well, I have no argument with what now exists. I simply suggest that it could bear scrutiny. Or could it? Yes, sir.
There's a popular criticism that the black clergyman is responsible because he advocates Christianity for maintaining the status quo of the black. How do you respond to criticism? Because he advocates Christian love instead of dealing violently with the problem as it exists, you know. And this criticism, I said, is involved with some blacks, and I wonder how you would cope with it, because sometimes we encounter the same criticism.
I took it in this way. There have been periods in our history in which the conservatism of the black clergy has been responsible for the survival of black people. There have been other periods in our history in which the radicalism of the black clergy has been all that we have that has led us from a situation of stasis to something higher. So, first of all, I should say that there is an extreme danger in generalizing about the black church. Because when you talk about the black church, you must talk in terms of at least two churches. There is not one black church, there are two. And you must talk in terms of periods of history. So that I would be quite willing to talk about this in detail, perhaps in one of the groups. But to make the generalization that the black clergy has been most responsible for the retardation of progress among blacks is at best a half truth. And at worst, it is an untruth. So you have to know what it is that you're talking about in much greater detail than is spoken on such an allegation.
I have a question, and I'd like to shift our thinking here for a moment. Your premise was basically, to begin with this morning, that our religious concepts in America have been greatly, pardon me, colored by the social environment in which we live. As a clergyman, I'd be interested to know not necessarily the sociological implications, but the theological implications of racism. I sense that you have a problem here when you talk about prejudice, that prejudice stems, I don't necessarily think so much from the environment, but from the human predicament of man.
How do you separate the human predicament of man from human experience and human environment? The human predicament of man is not an abstraction, it's a reality. And the reality has to be rooted in something, and I would rooted in human experience.
You may be referring to the difference between essence and existence.
All right. Whether you're the one to approach from an existentialist point of view, or whether you want to talk about it from the point of view of some more realistic perspective, then you will have to define for me what it is you mean, and then we can talk about it. As a social scientist with a theological background, it is very difficult for me, I admit, to talk about theological perspectives up here. Theological perspectives for me always ultimately rest down here, where we are. So then, while I recognize that this may be unacceptable to many of you, I put my prejudices out front where you can see them before we talk. Last question, go to our small group.
Before we go, we're off to a good start. Dr. Lincoln enjoys eating lunch with people, and there's a little roster right back by the pictures there. And for, say, seven or eight of you that would enjoy sitting down to coffee with Dr. Lincoln this noon or any noon this week, go ahead and sign up, and I'll reserve a table and you can go to line or make it.
And so as not to rob him of any more of his valuable time, I introduce him again. Dr. Lincoln.
Good morning, and thank you for letting me speak with you again. I'll be talking about the religious dimensions of black protests this morning, being well aware of the fact that different people often view a phenomenon from different perspectives and arrive at different conclusions. This was brought home to me quite early through the existence of a legend in my family about one of my ancestors. It seems that immediately after the Civil War, down in Albemarle County, Virginia, a certain master freed three of his slaves, and they bore the impressive names of Elisha, Elihu, and Elijah. And they turned out to have been ancestors of mine, and they walked from Albemarle County in Virginia to Giles County in Middle Tennessee, the site of the town of Pulaski. And one of them then walked from Giles County to Limestone County, Alabama, where he was fortuitous enough to meet a wagon train coming up from Savannah, Georgia. And in that wagon train coming from Savannah were my maternal ancestors. So when the Lincolns of Virginia met the Soles of Georgia, there was a great cataclysm which eventually resulted in myself. But that is not the point of the story. The point is that out of that initial union, there came a man whose name was Hinton. And he was a great circuit-riding preacher. He rode circuits from Limestone County, Alabama, up through southern Tennessee, over through western Tennessee, and back around to Limestone, a circuit requiring about 3 months. And there were all kinds of tales about how when the slough was up and the waters were flooded, that he would get out of his buggy and pray, and the waters would recede, and this sort of thing. But Uncle Hinton also wore a great big pistol tucked in his belt in order to quiet those members of his small congregations who got too exuberant in the infrequent meetings of the church. And the first thing he would do, it is said, when he walked up to the lectern, was to put his Bible on the lectern and his pistol just underneath. Now, all of you know that it wasn't too long ago that, particularly in certain denominations like the Methodists, that's before the Methodists became middle class, it was necessary to have a religious experience before you could be admitted into the church. Now, in the idiom of the black folk of the time, to have a religious experience meant to, quote, see something. You had to see something. And this meant, of course, that you had to see something very unusual and something that probably scared the hell out of you. Otherwise, what you were saying about religion just wasn't so. So on this particular Sunday afternoon, this individual in my great-grandfather's church, great-granduncle's church, rather, was testifying as to what he had seen. But my uncle was a little impatient because he still had one more church to make before dark. So this man was standing up. He was sort of reeling and rocking in a trance, saying that, I went down, yes, Lord, I went down to the graveyard. And there was a chorus from the sisters in the corner that says, yeah, Daddy, tell us what you see. And he said, well, I seen something, and it had a head like a cow, but it wasn't no cow. Yes, brother. And it had foots like a goat, but it wasn't no goat. Yes, tell it. And he went on like this for a while, and finally, my great uncle pulled his pistol out from under the lectern and put it on top of the lectern, and he said, sit down, brother, you ain't seen nothing but a mule. The point is, a great deal depends upon your religious fervor as to precisely what it is that you see. And sometimes we get lost in the ecstasy of spiritism and see things that are not there to be seen. But I hope that the things that I shall talk about this morning will sort of stand for themselves and will stand the test of historical investigation. I want to talk, as I say, about the religious dimensions of black protest. And in order to do this, I shall, of course, have to put the conversation into some kind of setting, and this setting will involve history that is common to you and is common to me. The big question arises immediately is, how do you protest when you are among a powerful alien people, a continent and an ocean away from friends and home? And this was the question which faced blacks who were the involuntary diaspora of West Africa for more than 300 years. What are the parameters of protest which will enable you to survive while at the same time changing or easing your situation? The very first protest began when the slaves were chained neck to neck and arm to arm and ankle to ankle in the cockles that moved out of the African interior and down to the beach to await the slave ships that would take them to this country. A very poignant story is told of a certain slave whose name was Neely, a female slave of 15 years or so, who became so distraught at the notion of being taken away from her own country that she clawed open her own throat and bled to death and had to be cut loose from the cockles rather than to be taken aboard a strange ship. The fact that thousands of slaves leaped overboard to the sharks and to their deaths in this way is well documented. If you really want some interesting reading about the economics of slavery, you might take a look at some of the records of Lloyd's of London, the same Lloyd's which today insures all kinds of improbable events, was in business during much of the slave period, and the records that I have seen in the British Museum and elsewhere make very interesting reading, both as to the profitability and as to the hazards of dealing in human flesh. But that is not what I really want to talk about today. What I want to talk about is protest and how protest could be effective and yet not overstep the bounds which made survival impossible. Once the slaves were in this country, they developed all kinds of stratagems for protest, many of which I have heard my own grandmother talk about, that ranged all the way from the burning of crops to the feeding of the master and members of his household food which contained ground glass. If you remember the little folk song that Jenny cracked corn and I don't care, Jenny cracked corn and I don't care, my master's gone away, very probably had to do with the fact that in the absence of the master, the slaves would frequently turn the stock into the cornfields, and in this way they would have some opportunity to vent their wrath or to vent their rage. They used many other strategies, of course, such as the maiming of animals, the destruction of tools and plows and things of this sort. But the most interesting thing is that over a period of time, protests came to be heavily freighted with a certain religious dimension which affected its character from that point forward. By the time of the most famous of the slave uprisings, those of Gabriel Prosser in 1800 and Denmark Vesey in 1832 and finally that of Nat Turner, practically every attempt on the part of the slaves to free themselves was prompted by the notion that it was contrary to the will of God that they ought to be held in bondage, and that being in bondage, they were unable to satisfactorily fulfill their obligations to God. So that the attempted liberation or the attempted freedom was very often tied in with the biblical notion that a man ought to be free, and that so long as he was unfree, he was unable to render to God the whole self, the whole body, the whole mind and spirit that earnest religion required and deserved. This ideology behind protest was carried on by such people as Henry McNeil Turner, who was one of the leading lights and a bishop in the Methodist Church, who advocated the return of large numbers of blacks in this country to Africa, for the primary reason that he had expected that in Africa they would be free of their obligations to man and would thereby be able to better fulfill their total obligations to God. Even in so recent a time, the time of Marcus Garvey in the 1920s and just before the 1920s, when the Garvey movement had perhaps as many as 5 million followers, and when his scheme for the repatriation of large numbers of these people to Africa was in its heyday, the the first thing that Garvey did was to establish a church for the oversight of the religious protest that was involved in his movement, persuading the Episcopal priest, Dr. Wright, to take over the religious aspects of his whole movement in order that the protest that he envisioned would be a protest that would be guided by and would lie within the parameters of the Christian spirit. Protest, even in some of the more notorious black cults, has almost always had a religious dimension. For example, as early as 1917, when the so-called prophet Noble Drew Ali came out of North Carolina and established Muslim cults in Chicago and Philadelphia and Newark and various other places, the central notion was that so long as black people were Christians, they could not and would not be permitted the kind of freedom necessary to worship God effectively. Therefore, it was Noble Drew's strategy to disabuse blacks of the notion that they were Negroes and to persuade them to change their religious affiliation from Christian to Muslim. And to this end, he issued identification cards to his followers, which bore a legend to the effect that I am not a Negro, I am a Muslim, and therefore entitled to certain kinds of rights which will permit my free religious expression. It is very possible that the seed for the seed of what we have come to call Muslimism was sown by Noble Drew Ali in that early period, and it was so attractive, or it seemed to have such possibility that since that time, literally thousands of blacks have become Muslims of one sort or another because they have felt that they could not satisfactorily express their religious needs in this country as Christians. So then we have the more recent phenomenon of the black Muslims, a group that I have spent a number of years studying and writing about, a group under the leadership of Master Fard Muhammad, which began in Detroit in the 1930s and has continued under the leadership of Elijah Muhammad until this day, and which produced such people as the late Malcolm X. The tragedy, if there is a tragedy, in this kind of religio-social protest is that the people were convinced, for whatever reason, that they had to change their religions in order to find the freedom to worship God under the best kinds of circumstances. This is, of course, a commentary on the way in which Christianity has been expressed in this country, and it is also an implied commentary on the relationship between the Christian faith and the phenomenon of racism. Black people, very early after they became Christians, came to rely upon and to expect a divine deliverance from their problems. But it has to be pointed out that contrary to the notions which have become embedded in our traditions, black people were not admitted to the Christian church in any substantial numbers for more than 100 years after they were first imported into this country as slaves. As a matter of fact, there was a tradition that the bringing of a slave to Christ jeopardized his status as a slave, because in England, at least, whenever a slave confessed Christianity, it was considered an act which immediately effected his manumission. Though this was never the practice in this country, and there is not, to my findings, a single incident in which this occurred, there was the strong belief in the possibility that this might occur. So then, in the South, where there was a real vested interest in the institution of slavery, the Southern planters resisted every effort to bring Christ to the slaves. But it was not only true of the South, it was also true of the North, where the Northerners were convinced by whatever numbers of blacks there were among them. I do recall a note from the governor of Massachusetts about the middle of the 17th century to someone in London, and he was writing to the effect that so far as he knew, not a single black anywhere in the colony had been admitted to any existing church. Further research, incidental research, revealed that the governor was wrong. There was one. There was a woman who lived in Dorchester, Massachusetts, during the period, who, being a likely and comely candidate for the faith, or worse to that effect, and who had belonged to a physician, was admitted to full membership in the church. But the prevailing tradition up until 1701 was that blacks should be kept out of the church And at the same time, they were prevented from, discouraged from practicing whatever religion they knew in Africa. So for 100 years, blacks in this country were in a sort of religious limbo. They were not admitted to Christianity, and they were discouraged from pursuing the religious practices that they knew in Africa. And this fact becomes very important when we try to assess the behavior of blacks when they are protesting their unfreedom in relationship to their religious beliefs. Now, the notion, as I said, that God will deliver his people, that Ethiopia will stretch forth her wings, that righteousness shall prevail, and that the meek shall inherit the earth, eventually became very deeply embedded in the sight patterns of black America and remain so to this day. As a matter of fact, protest organizations like the NAACP made no significant impression upon the black populace at all until those organizations associated themselves with the churches. If the pastor joined the NAACP, the people would join. And if a victory was won in the courts, it was considered to be God's victory, or people were very cautious not to set too much store by it, as only God could bring about true change in their circumstances. Black people have always taken their religion very seriously. In the African past, religion was part and parcel of the system of justice and of the I-thou relationship, which illustrated the social relations of blacks in Africa before they were imported to this country. Now, the burden of the religious message that was eventually brought to blacks once the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts had given up the notion of converting the Indians, whom they found quite hostile to the idea, and had turned their attention to blacks after having gained the permission of the southern planters on the theory that a Christianized slave would become a more valuable possession because of the fact that in the very process of Christianization, he would be taught loyalty, truthfulness, diligence, and so on. And again, a certain New England divine, Cotton Mather, actually grew ecstatic over the benefits that would be reaped by ye masters if only ye would bring your blacks and your Negroes to Christ. Mather went on to say that the windows of heaven would open up to pour out felicitations upon the people who took advantage of putting their slaves and servants in a condition of greater loyalty and obedience, which was implied in making Christians of them. So then, the Christianization of the slave meant that the slave was taught that to rebel against his master or to waste or abuse his master's property, including his own body, was a sin against God, who had established the master-servant relationship. It also taught that the physical person of the master was absolutely inviolable, and the penalty for breaking this taboo was limited only by the imagination of the master. Common penalties for insubordination, which covered both an aggressive act against the master and an impertinent attitude, which was equated at the same, as the same thing, included branding, cropping, that is, the removal of one or both ears and the nose, hamstringing, which was a very vicious practice of cutting the tendon in the heel, castration, pickling. Pickling was the practice of flogging a man until his wounds were laid open, and then rubbing in salt, and after a period of hours, flogging him again. And this continued in many cases until the man had died. And death itself. These were penalties for protesting in any manner which threatened the physical security of the master. These atrocities were not incidental, but their intent was to give resistance the quality of sinfulness. The whole notion being that slavery was ordained of God, and that the master only stood in that relationship because it was God's will that he should, and that any revolt against the master was a revolt against the will of God. Slaves who killed their masters or who ran away could not be given a Christian burial. And this was an expectation extremely dear to a people who had been persuaded to believe that the good life for them could only begin at the point of death or after death. So then, for the vast majority of slaves, the notion of being buried without the traditional Christian rites was absolutely unacceptable. And the overtones of this ideology still permeate the black community to this day, and is in part responsible for the tremendous attention given to the burial rites and to the funeral doings at the time of death. Hence, the notion that protest, especially violent protest, would incur very serious risk, both practical and spiritual, tempered the nature of black protest from the very beginning and has never been completely absent from any consideration of how to effect black liberation. As a matter of fact, I remember an aphorism of Malcolm X, which spoke at least obliquely to the situation. Malcolm once said that the black American could be the bravest man in the world, that whenever he was told to go and sick the Germans, he went over and bit the Germans. And he was told to sick the Japanese, he risked his life in all kinds of courageous activities in order to carry out the orders that were given him concerning the people who were pointed out as his enemies. Yet, said Malcolm, the same black soldier could return to the United States laden down with all kinds of medals for bravery, and he could observe the white man, and here I quote, He could observe that the white man would hang his father from a tree and have his mother in the streets, and he would stand there with his knees knocking and his tail wagging, wondering what he ought to do.